Welcome to CELTCast, the bi-weekly podcast from the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching at Concordia University, Wisconsin in Ann Arbor. Your hosts, Rob Balza, Kate Robertson, and Carrie Bierke, bring you conversations with professors and thought leaders from around the world, sharing fresh insights on teaching and learning. This academic year, 2025-26, we're focusing on one of the most transformative forces in education today, artificial intelligence. Whether you're a faculty member, educational leader, or simply passionate about learning, CELTCast is your space to explore ideas, spark curiosity, and imagine the future of education together.
Well, welcome to the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching at Concordia University, Wisconsin. I'm your host, Rob Balza, and with me today is my co-host, Carrie Bierke. You want to say hi, Carrie?
Hello.
And we have a very special guest coming to us from Concordia University, Irvine, Dr. Eugene Kim. And Dr. Kim is the founder and president of Integrated Education. Yeah, he does teacher training and strategic planning initiatives in China, holds a PhD in comparative education from UCLA, and he's currently professor of leadership at Concordia University in Irvine, California, so our sister university. And formerly, he was an assistant professor at Pepperdine, taught for a number of years in high school in Los Angeles, and has published widely in a variety of journals, and recently gave a presentation on artificial intelligence here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that I was fortunate enough to attend. And I was so interested in what you had to say, Dr. Kim, that I was really excited to meet you afterwards and invite you onto our new podcast. And thank you so much for coming.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
So could you tell us how you got interested in artificial intelligence? When you first heard of it and kind of what got you interested in that area and how did you start speaking on the topic?
Sure. Well, I think most of us are probably introduced to AI through popular literature and popular film, you know, all the movies that we've seen growing up from Terminator to Star Trek to you name it, right? But I think that my introduction to what I'm going to sort of call out as generative AI, what we sort of recognize as being sort of the contemporary version of that AI when we think about ChatGPT, that's generative AI. So my introduction to generative AI actually happened one Christmas. It was December of 2022, and my daughter had come home from college. And as she normally does when she comes home from college, she comes excited and wanting to share about what's been going on her campus. And she says, "Hey, Dad, I want to show you something." I said, "Sure, let's sit down." And so she pulls up a computer and she says, "Hey, Dad, what are, like, call out like just two of your favorite things in the world." And I said, "All right, how about puppies and ice cream?" So she types puppies and ice cream and she types a couple more words. And then she turns the computer around like in the blink of an eye. And there's this poem about puppies and ice cream. I think, oh, that's clever. Like she Google searched a poem about puppies and ice cream. I thought, okay. She turns it around. She says, "No, Dad, that's not what I did. Here, throw another word in there, but another favorite thing of yours that's not related to puppies and ice cream." So I said, "How about Mazda Miata?" So she types in Mazda Miata. She turns it around again, just 1 second later, turns it around, shows me this beautiful, beautiful poem about puppies and ice cream and Mazda Miatas. And I'm thinking, wait a second here, what's going on? Is there someone behind the screen, like coming up with these poems, like instantaneously? Like, how is this happening? And she says, "Dad, keep throwing out words." And she says, "Okay, how about iambic pentameter? How about Shakespearean? How about a haiku?" She just keeps throwing in different things into this black box. And she turns her computer around every single time, a beautifully written poem. And I'm thinking at that moment, our world is about to change. So I would say that was my introduction to AI. Have been consulting in the area of AI, doing research in the area of AI, particularly with AI and its intersection with education. So I don't design AI large language models. I don't train them. I don't work in the engineering space or the coding space. My direct interaction with AI has to do with how does AI impact teaching and learning? More specifically, my research is centered on the adoption cycle of AI at K-12 levels and higher ed levels specifically, and looking at how we can promote ethical, responsible, but also faithful AI adoption. And so that's probably, like, in a nutshell, what I'm working on today.
That's amazing. Many of us have had that kind of eye-opening first experience with AI in the last couple of years.
Right.
And it can be shocking, you know, when you first ask it to rewrite things you've wrote and the style of different authors, or One of my family's favorite things to do is to ask it to generate a funny poem in the style of MC Hammer or something like that. And we say it back to each other and laugh. And but I mean, there's serious implications of this stuff too, right? Effect on various job sectors and things like that. I'm curious your thoughts on what job sectors might be most impacted, particularly those job sectors that, where we're training students to enter those job sectors in higher education right now at Concordia universities around the world.
Rob, such a good question, but also such a germane question for higher ed, right? As we're thinking about what our student learning outcomes are in our programs, I think a lot of times those student outcomes are aligned to sort of our ideals for what type of students we want to produce in higher ed. But I think sometimes, not all the times, but sometimes those things are disconnected from the realities of the workplace. And I think now more than ever, we need to not only invest in our developmental knowledge of what's happening in industry across all different fields, but also how AI is shifting all of that and how AI is potentially disrupting all of that as well too. So I would say, given the dozens of articles and a new articles come out every single week, sort of premonitions of what the future holds, because AI, frankly speaking, AI doesn't stand still. Every time you turn around, there's a new version, a new update to AI. There's a new model. There's a new app that uses that model, and the new applications in the workplace. And so we see what we consider sort of like long-term, long-range trends and predictions. Those things sort of get thrown out the door, and we just have to be reflexive. And so when you ask, what are the jobs of the future, and how does AI affect that and impact that direction, it's hard for me to give you a really good answer. And that the reason why is we don't, I, nobody knows what even 6 months from today will look like in terms of AI. And then we have to calculate then if that's the state of AI, how does that particular version of AI or that particular level or intelligence of AI, how does that then impact jobs and job development? So I would say, given all the research that's been published in this area for the last couple of years by the major players, so I'm talking about the large consultancy firms, I'm talking about the UN or the World Bank or the World Economic Forum, or I'm talking about White House economists, or again, colleagues, or economists, our colleagues and folks in schools of business across the U.S. And then add to that all of the tech CEOs. Add to that, I think the people that are probably the most relevant people to ask this question of is actually not sort of the forecasters. It's the people that are hiring our young people, right? So when you're talking to tech CEOs, all of that gets mixed up. But I would say that the range of job displacement within the next 5 years and 2030 is supposed to be an inflection point. So by 2030, we're supposed to see a major disruption. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not like a 9.0 earthquake that happens out of the blue. It's something that we'll see tremors of it building up, sort of like when you're sort of predicting volcanic eruptions, you can sometimes tell that things are happening before they happen. And so we're going to start seeing some of that. And it's already happening today. It's been happening last year and the year before, in fact. When we're looking at, for example, we're looking at large tech companies. You look at, for example, Meta, which is the parent organization of Facebook, one of the largest tech companies in the world. They have been gradually, continuously, and very quietly, in fact, laying off thousands and thousands of their employees every single year since ChatGPT. One of the clients that I work with, I do some executive coaching on the side, and one of the clients I work with was a mid-level coder for Meta. And he, well, our conversations started to move towards transition in terms of what now. He had formerly worked for Google as a mid-level coder and then had most recently been at Meta. Was let go from Meta along with hundreds of his colleagues. So again, mid-level coders and below, he's reporting back to me that this is actually happening. But at the beginning of this year, Mark Zuckerberg made a public pronouncement that AI is now as good as the best of his coders at Meta, at Facebook, at Instagram. And he had decided already at that point that he is going to make major changes in hiring and retention. In terms of employees, and he's going to start with his coders. I think he said that he's going to replace the majority of his coders with AI. Again, because of the state of AI and its ability to code better than almost any human being on the face of the planet. And so you see examples like that. I mean, that's anecdotal, but you also see reports of thousands and thousands of, again, jobs that were probably like, if you ask young people, what are sort of the top jobs to get into? I would say maybe even top three, coder would be up there. Coders, Silicon Valley coders are making between 150 to 300,000 K within about 3 to 4 years of being in the workplace. That's an incredible salary, not including benefits, including stock options and all that in those major companies. And so, again, when we're seeing those jobs that were sort of preeminent in terms of like what young people were thinking about in terms of marketability, now we're seeing the reversal of that. And we're seeing that those are the first jobs to go. So any job that requires high levels of intelligence, I'm sorry to say this, but higher ed, we're going to see major disruptions. All the researchers, so all the R1 universities, first and foremost, are going to see major disruptions because AI is going to be able to do all the research that humans are doing. About 95% of all the research, the heavy research, scientific research, even social research that humans are now doing and getting, millions of dollars of funding for. I feel like some of the government cuts in research funding are not random. I feel like some of them are preemptive. I think that the government has information that we don't have, and they're seeing AI eventually replacing those researchers. And their cutting of funding of research, I think, is not arbitrary. I think it's, again, a response to times to come, and they're getting ready for this major disruption. Again, any kind of high intelligence job, any kind of high level white collar job, anyone who works in an office, or worse, anyone who works remotely. Anyone who works remotely is very easily replaced by AI because they have very little human to human interaction. I would say the more human to human interaction, this is getting to your question now. The more human to human interaction you have in your job, the more safe you are. And so,
Interesting.
especially as a necessity, right? Not by circumstance, but by necessity, right? So I would say jobs like, let's talk about medicine, first of all. So in medicine, it would be folks that are doing like physical therapy, occupational therapy, nurses, physician's assistants. Now, I'm sort of avoiding the doctors and the surgeons, and there's a reason why. Again, the highest, the jobs with the highest level training requiring sort of the highest levels of intelligence are going to be the first to be replaced by AI. So a lot of our frontline medical doctors, our general practitioners, our internists, our even pediatricians, family doctors, a lot of them are already being replaced. If you've been to a doctor's office, you probably noticed they're already being replaced by nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. That's going to accelerate with AI. So again, human to human contact and interaction, those are the jobs that are going to last longer in this AI age and are going to be in more demand. The jobs that require less human to human interaction, with the addition of requiring, high levels of training or intelligence, those are probably the first jobs to go.
That's fascinating. So my background is in biochemistry, and one of the most amazing things that I've seen in the course of my career is how, it used to take years of painstaking work to grow crystals, shoot X-rays through them, measure diffraction patterns, and solve crystal structures with advanced math, and how, one of the early AI tools, AlphaFold, was able to generate, hundreds of thousands or millions of structures in just a matter of minutes.
That's right.
Of course, it's built upon all that painstaking work, but that's laid the foundation for basically, solving how strings of amino acids fold together to form proteins. And then seeing what the first generation technologies for radiology were doing, identifying spots
That's right.
in X-rays and CT scans and things like this. It's certainly an impact industry, and appreciate that insight. That's fascinating stuff. One of the things a lot of colleges and universities are thinking about right now is, how do we prepare for that future? Number one, like thinking about everything you just said in terms of the impact on the workforce, like how do we prepare our students to enter careers that are going to be in demand? How do we adjust programmatic offerings in light of that? And then also, how do we retool our faculty? And so, the Center for Excellence Learning and Teaching that Carrie and I are involved in, a big part of our role is helping to support faculty development, training, and things like that. Do you have any thoughts or recommendations for what we can do to help support faculty as we transition to the age of AI here?
I'd probably say three things, and I want to be a little bit careful about this just because every institution is different. Every institution has its own culture, and every institution has their own context and history. So I want to be a little bit careful about sort of giving advice to another institution, but I would say in general, three things. Number one, I think that we all need to upskill, right? So we all need to learn about AI in general. So what is it as a technology, and where is it going? I think that's a necessity. It's not something we can sort of ignore anymore. We need it just like when we all have to have some working knowledge of how smartphones work, or the internet works, or how laptop computers. We don't need to know how the electronics work in it, but we have to know how it functions and how it aids human beings in their work. And so, in the same way, I think we have to have some a primer of knowledge around AI, and particularly its intersection with education and our work as educators. So I'd say number one, sort of general education and upskilling in the area of AI. I would say secondly, I would say a focus on how AI interfaces with your particular field. So if you're a historian, if you're a biochemist, if you are an educator, whatever field you're working in, what are the advances in AI in that field? And then how does that impact the kind of knowledge and skills that you want to pass down to your students, right? So content specific, domain specific, AI interactions with your field. I would say the third thing, though, is a willingness and maybe even an eagerness to explore, to have curiosity, to experiment, to maybe even to the point of encountering failures, and then getting back up and then trying again with AI, like using it both for your professional use, but also for your professional use as educators, and looking at how AI could increase and amplify learning. And then also, on the other hand, speaking into that with a critical voice, because AI is imperfect. The difference between generative AI and our sort of our other iterations of AI that have come decades before, and that run alongside, they're still here, are what some might call rules-based AI, where there is an input and an output, and those are deterministic. There's a specific algorithm that'll, if you enter A, it'll give you B. With generative AI, there is no precise algorithm. The algorithm is a probability, right? So it'll select the next word in a sequence of words to end the sentence or to complete a sentence. And so that ends up being very non-deterministic. And so being non-deterministic, you're adding to the product, the output, a degree of randomness and a degree of error. That's implicit in the model, that there's a degree of chaos there. And chaos, again, some of it's good and some of it's not. And we're trying to train AI so that it's giving us more of the good and less of the bad. But it's trained on the world's data. And the world data has a lot of good in it, but it has a lot of trash in it. It's garbage in, garbage out, as they say. And so there's a lot of garbage on the internet as well too. And so trying to work through all that, trying to train our systems so that, again, they are more accurate rather than less. But in the interim, until we get there, we have to train ourselves and then train our young people to be critical consumers, not only of AI, but all information, right? Whether it's news media, whether it's the internet, whether it's social media, whether it's like your neighbor down the street telling you something, or your professor in the classroom. We have to train our young people to be critical learners and not just memorizers of information that we're seeing and hearing.
That's great.
I think too, like we have faculty who are ready to hit the ground running, but we also have a lot that are skeptical or even fearful of bringing this into the classroom and their online courses. And I guess the other side of that is if we do kind of get them on board to be open to upskilling, it can be overwhelming too, because there's so much change and so quickly. So do you have any kind of advice or recommendations on how we can kind of tackle faculty development in a way that helps everyone embrace it but not feel overwhelmed?
Wow, that's another big question, right? And again, I don't know anything about the makeup of your faculty and where they are. I've developed over the past 2 years an AI adoption inventory where the inventory assesses an individual's, and usually they're educators, but an individual's openness and proclivity to AI adoption. So, and it also looks at their behaviors and their beliefs about AI. So it places them on a spectrum. There are basically six stages of AI adoption. From a skeptic that doesn't use it at all to someone who's a champion of AI, who's doing the work that you're doing. Obviously, you're here because you're champions of this, and you're trying to mentor and train and teach others, right, in thoughtful and faithful ways. And then there are stages in between. And so the AI, this adoption inventory helps to stage individuals, helping them to think through, okay, so, you know, what are the areas where I'm comfortable and where are the areas that I'm not? And then what are my reasons for that? The second part of this inventory, it also taps into there are five determinant factors that allow us to look at what are the things that would support an individual's development along an AI adoption spectrum and continuum. And those five things are pretty consistent. As I've looked at educators both at K through 12, but also higher ed levels, the same kinds of influences and impacts show up. And again, those include everything from self-efficacy to your beliefs about the benefits of AI in education to your community, whether you're seeing other people that you trust and respect using AI effectively, whether you're getting support from your institution, your administration. And then the fifth category is something that I've been surprised that that's risen to the surface. That's almost like a meta factor. It almost influences the accessibility of all those other factors, which is emotional resonance, which is what you were saying, Carrie, which is, you know, faculty are coming in with a degree of skepticism, with a degree of maybe even resistance, but also with fear and with a little bit of anxiety even around AI. AI presents not only a new type of technology that potentially could add to our workload, but it also presents a competing intelligence. You know, we call it artificial intelligence because it's considered a type of intelligence, right? It's not human intelligence, but it's a digital intelligence. And so that digital intelligence, because it is so smart, it's threatening to us, especially those of us who work in knowledge economies. It's threatening to us because that is what we've been trained in. That's why we're doing the work we're doing, because we work in this area of intelligence. And so it is threatening to us. And so there's this fear that, will it replace me? Or will it change my, even if it doesn't replace me, will it change my job in ways that I'm not comfortable with? So, you know, those are the things that I'm seeing come up over and over and again. And so the work that I do, you know, Rob mentioned seeing me at a professional development for 350 educators in Milwaukee. And my primary goal in that session is, well, I would say probably two or three goals there. Number one is to, again, educate everyone in terms of where is AI and where is it going, how does it intersect with education. But I'd say secondly, probably even more importantly, I want people to feel safe in that space, to be able to ask questions and to be able to say, I'm afraid of this, or I'm not comfortable with this. Does that mean that I can't be part of this conversation anymore? And the response is, no, we're all in that space. I'm there too. I'm afraid of it. I have anxiety around it. I've been confronting those things. I've been working through those things, but I have those very same emotional responses to AI. And so we're all in this together. And so having sort of a consensus of, you know, that we're all in this together, and that none of us is, I mean, frankly speaking, even if you started off when ChatGPT was announced to the world 2.5 years ago, you're only maybe a year or two ahead of everyone else. It's not like no one is in education, in the intersection of AI and education, is so far ahead that their peers can't catch up. I mean, we're sort of all one pace ahead or one pace behind of the other. And so just getting everyone to see that and recognize that we're in this together, and that there's sort of this shared space, emotional space, that we can work through. I think that is probably the most important thing to do with faculty. And then to offer up, I would say, as opposed to institutionalize, more grassroots opportunities for faculty to come together and share what they're thinking, share what they're reading, share what they're trying with AI. And so at Concordia Irvine, one of the things that I did this past year was to start what I called an AI cafe. And so I just put a little paper tent up in the cafeteria, and every, you know, one Wednesday every month, I would invite faculty to just show up. And there's no curriculum, there's no book to read, there's no assignments that you have to complete before you get there. There's no sort of like top-down level accountability. It's just faculty that just want to talk, that just want to ask questions, that just want to listen to one another, that just want to share out. And so we did that for a year, and we've been seeing some real momentum shifts on our campus. The School of Ed in particular, I would say we've got probably about a 95% AI adoption at the School of Education, and that all happened this past year. So I would say, start with where people are in terms of their emotional resonance with AI, and then offer up safe spaces for them.
Dr. Kim, that's some excellent advice. Thank you very much. We're going to be working very hard on this issue here at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and appreciate your advice and leadership as we move forward with that initiative. We're out of time for today. Thanks and blessings on your fall semester at UC Irvine.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to CELTcast, brought to you by the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching at Concordia University, Wisconsin in Ann Arbor. We hope today's conversation gave you something valuable to take away, whether a new idea to apply in your teaching practice or simply a perspective to consider further. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can find us on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Production for this episode was done by Ashley Curtin. Until next time, thank you for joining us and keep teaching faithfully.